Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for clicking on the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, something almost completely different. Recently, I was exposed to the artistic creations of a Bay Area artist named Al Farrow. Powerful, provocative, political themes in sculptures and other things that he builds entirely from bullets and guns. The message, like I say, is extremely powerful, and I think he conveys it well in this conversation that I had at his studio and machine shop yesterday. This podcast is made possible by the people who provide me with a little money, for God's sake. People like Julie Anders and Eugene Hetzel, who just renewed their annual subscriptions. And other people like Judy Holloway and Linda Gray, who are solid monthly subscribers here. I invite you to join them. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where we've got bonus books dangling for you. I appreciate your support.
I've dropped into the San Rafael, California studio of artist Al Farrow. Al, for my listeners, they can't see this depiction of a church that you have created, but all of the elements are based on different forms of weapons, bullets, guns, bayonets. Can you describe for our listeners this church spire and what it's made of?
Well, let me give you the gist of the whole piece. I call it Revelation 1, and it's a Protestant church. A lot of my work is Catholic or Jewish or Muslim, but Protestants are harder to make fun of or deal with because they're not ornate. So I really worked hard to find an iconic church for the Protestant to represent the Protestants in this series. So this piece is like an old country church. Could be from New England, North Dakota, whatever, but it's a small neo-Gothic late 19th century style church. The spire is made of bayonets, and it spreads out into a flare like many do in Protestant, and I'm using snub-nose gun barrels for that. The shingles are flattened bullets, and each bullet gets flattened individually with 20,000 PSI in a hydraulic press, and then I use them as shingles. If I overpress with too much pressure, it mushrooms and it doesn't look like a flat bullet. If I don't have enough pressure, then of course they're not a uniform thickness. So this takes forever. The siding is made of 30 caliber carbine shells, and the main frame of the house or the church is Luger's. Mm-hmm. So the floor around it is all shot from shotgun shells. And so almost everything is some kind of element of violence. Some of the structure is rifle barrels, some are pistol barrels, some of the whole pistols. And the only thing that's not armament is the ridge beam and the frames of the windows. That's about it. And some of my pieces, they too are armament.
Now let's walk over here to this menorah, really imposing work here. And the base of it is a gear from a big rig truck. Then we have a ring of bullets here around the Star of David. That's the foundation for a machine gun barrel with the aeration holes in it.
Yeah, this is the that's the jacket, the barrel's inside. That's an MG-34, which is a Nazi-era machine gun. So that's the center element. The arms are made of four pistols each from the Vichy French government. They're French automatic pistols. Mm-hmm. I've taken the barrel out, and I'm just using the frames, but they're all welded together very elegantly. You cannot see the welds or anything.
And the owner of this piece will also get this ammunition box here, which includes the candles for this menorah.
Right. There's enough for a couple of seasons. it's just an accessory, but, you know, you got to store your candles somewhere, so ammo box. Box is perfect for this. That's the ammo.
So I saw one of your pieces recently at a gallery in San Francisco, and Catherine Clark, who is your agent, she showed me a book of the Divine Ammunition series.
Yeah.
So how did you get started creating art out of munitions?
Well, actually, it started earlier because my earlier work addressed violence and arming indigenous cultures and all kinds of abuses of weaponry. So, and that was figurative work in bronze. It was not very popular, and people got it, but they wouldn't buy it. And I think part of it has to do with, you know, seeing, I call my African series, one of them, seeing naked men with guns. Naked black men with guns scares the white guys who often buy the art. So honestly, they didn't sell. Mm-hmm. Mostly artists got them, and I sold some, but I traded a lot of them to other artists. I needed my work to evolve. I needed it to go beyond that figuration. And I was traveling in Italy, and I was looking at a lot of reliquaries, and I found a finger in Florence, in one of the Medici chapels, and it just literally triggered the entire series in my head. It was, you know, like a mental explosion. I saw in my mind trigger finger. So I don't like to insult anybody's religion or anything, even though I play off all the religions. So I made up my own saint. Mm-hmm. That's Santo Guerrero. And Santo Guerrero, it's just a play on the word for war in Italian. It's actually guerra. But I wanted to masculinize the word because in all the Romance languages, the word for war is feminine, which, I mean, some people can make a case for it, but I'm not making a case for it. I'm making a case for actual shooting wars traditionally are started and finished by men.
So, Alfaro, I only know a little about you. You came out here to California from New York. When?
I came in 1967, Summer of Love, to the Bay Area.
That's 50 years ago.
Yeah. That's a long time. I'm old. I'm 73 now.
And was it the Vietnam War that informed your politics?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was World War II as well, growing up in New York City and having neighbors with numbers on their arms and all sorts of, you know, exposure to that sort of thing, seeing pictures growing up.
You showed me a piece with the Enola Gay, which dropped the bombs in Japan, and you fashioned a crucifix under the belly of it.
Yeah, the hanging one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was... that was a statement about bombing in general, as well as throwing atom bombs around, and we're the only country in the world that did it. So I thought we'd put a little responsibility out there.
Did Vietnam radicalize you, Al?
Yeah, I was definitely against the war, and I became very politically involved when I was about 18, and so I was a political activist for a young person, and I was up against the draft. And I didn't want to fight that war. I'm not a conscientious objector. I would fight in a war that I felt was just. I think World War II was just. But I didn't think the Vietnam War was. And so I protested, and I wrote letters, and I did all the things that people are doing today. Mm-hmm. But I found it really ineffective, particularly when Nixon and Johnson were presidents. And they totally ignored mass demonstrations and just went ahead and did anything they wanted anyway. And so I thought, you know, I've got to put my thoughts and my feelings into something more substantial, something more than a piece of paper.
And in your view, has the U.S. fought a just war since Vietnam?
No, not at all. Grenada, Guatemala, forget about the Middle East, Iraq, and all that. No, I have not supported any of the wars.
The liberation of Panama?
No, I have a lot more history on that with Noriega.
He was our guy. He was an asset.
Yeah, he was a CIA. Yeah. I mean, I read tons about. I actually did a sculpture of him in another series I call my Membranes series. But but this was actually, I expanded it into ancient Peruvian terracotta. And I did a warrior vessel of Fidel Castro, and I did a prisoner vessel of Noriega. Mm. They're really, really good sculptures. But they got into a show in a museum down in Silicon Valley, and they put them right in the front. I mean, it really made a very strong statement, because they were doing, that was a show called 500 Years Since Columbus, and it was like right in there. I mean, it really hit the mark. But Noriega has a real interesting history, and, you know, he got out of jail in Florida. And then France, they sent him over to France, and now he's going to jail in France. I guess it all has to do with cocaine and stuff like that. But it was, but he was one nasty dude, and he learned all his tricks here from us.
Yeah,
working
so
with us.
So, what is the source of your political activism? Do you follow certain news reports? Do you read a lot? Do you travel? Because your work here is very deep, and it operates on so many levels. I gain so many different perceptions from it. And you clearly have a pretty strong knowledge of the politics that you are building your expression on.
I do read. I'm a reader. I've read a lot of Chris Hedges' work, like War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Incredibly good book. By the way, he wrote the foreword in the catalog for my recent shows.
I didn't know that. I know Chris.
Do you really?
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah, I've interviewed him many times.
Oh,
he's a brilliant man.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Anyway, I love his books. And a friend of his, who's also a friend of mine, because I've never met Chris in person, but he asked him to write that for me. And he looked at my work, and he agreed to do it. And I was really pleased, because he gave the most succinct description of my work that I've ever seen.
Can you quote it?
No, but I can show it to you.
Okay. Now, let's walk out into the main studio here, because when I entered, I'm not really shocked, but this is much more of a machine shop than a traditional art studio.
Well, it's been everything. I've had a foundry here when I used to cast bronze. I've carved wood. I've carved stone. But it's an evolving space that whatever my current projects are will inform the machinery.
So when I walked in, you were machining some bullet parts into a piece that you're building, which is the Trump White House.
Yes. That's a shift for me. It's shifting gears from religion and war to politics and war, which I addressed before in my earlier series. But this is new. This is a new era. This is possibly the most disturbing time in my life, at least for me.
So Trump famously, a few weeks ago, responded to the death of what he called beautiful babies in Syria from a chemical incident which has been blamed on the Syrian government. But there's pretty good evidence to counter that. And Professor Ted Postol, emeritus from MIT, wrote a series of articles debunking the claims from the White House that this could have been an aerial sarin attack because of the evidence that he saw on the ground. Do you have any doubts about what our government said occurred there?
I have doubts about everything and anything that comes out of President Trump's mouth. I My wife is extraordinarily political, and she gets really wound up around all this stuff. I don't tend to get wound up too much. I just tell her all the time, don't listen to what he says. Just watch what he does. See what he can accomplish or can't accomplish. And that's what you got to react to. Because words are just words. And he lies. And he, you know, he doesn't read. He's doesn't have curiosity. He's ill-informed.
And do you think he's running the deep state, or is the deep state running him?
That's to be determined. I don't really know. I think that he has a certain handle on his own approach, which is that he likes being the boss and he wants to rule by decree, but he can't because there are checks and balances, even with the Republicans controlling all the branches of government. There's still checks and balances, and my wife totally freaked out when they won Senate, House, and presidency, and I said, no, we still have power to block, to change, to shift, and that's, we've got evidence of that a lot. We're really working with what we've got. Mm-hmm. And I'm positively inclined. I've always find the silver lining. I think that really bad times force change.
And let me offer this, because I was a sharp critic of many of the military and foreign policy moves of Barack Obama. While many Americans just said, oh, he's a good guy, we trust him, and they kind of checked out. But now, because Trump is such an obvious threat, people are taking to the streets. We're having protests almost every weekend in cities across the country. There's a May Day protest here in San Rafael today.
That's great. I love this. I think that people got really complacent, particularly under the Bush administration. I think that we didn't get much activism, despite how many people were upset with all those efforts in Iraq and the Middle East. I really think that all of this leads to people organizing, really looking at all the information and acting. And this is something that should have been going on a lot longer. It should have been going on, you know, during the Iraq war. We had protests, but, and even international protests, but it was not on this scale. And this is the stuff that will bring change. Mm-hmm. And I see it as positive because, you know, you know the British always say it's going to get worse before it gets better. And it's getting worse, but it's going to get better. And it's a pendulum thing. And if you really look at politics, the pendulum always swings. The country, the people get tired of a Democrat or a Republican in office, and they will, after two terms, they'll switch. And even for no good reason, it's just they're looking for something else, you know.
Can you tell that to Hillary?
I don't know. I would love to be able to sit down and talk to her, though.
I think she comes out to Bolinas every once in a while to stay with Susie Tompkins, yeah.
No kidding. Well, I've met a few people here. One of the curators, I was in a show recently at the Marin Headlands called Homeland Security, and it was in the bunkers by the Golden Gate Bridge, and I had that church that we described in that show and a mosque, and the curator for that show told me that in her earlier show when Ai Weiwei was showing on
Alcatraz.
Yeah, so this is the same organization and the same curator, and she told me that Hillary Clinton came and spent a lot of time looking at the work and discussing it at length and really getting into it. And I asked her, because I don't really, you hear all this crazy talk about Hillary Clinton, I asked, what do you think about as a personality? And she said she was actually quite warm and engaging and curious and all the things Trump isn't. So,
Al, she is such a hawk, all right? She led the charge to invade Libya. She was chomping at the bit to go into Syria, and Obama said no. My sense is she looks at your work with different eyes than you and I.
She hasn't seen my work yet, as far as I know. I would be curious to see her response, you know. I don't shift gears for anybody. I just do what I feel like doing because I just have a personal confidence. I've been doing this a really long time, as you figured out.
Yeah. So, and you've been able to make a living as an artist your entire adult life?
Not my entire adult life, no. No. In recent years, things are way better. Huh. I struggled a lot over the years, you know, financially. But I never struggled with my work. Hmm. My work is clear to me. Yeah. You know, I have a purpose. I have a lot of content and in the artwork, and it's intended not so much for consumption today as to reflect these times. Mm-hmm. I figure that once I'm gone, the work is still speaking.
Yeah.
They don't really need my words.
Well, when I saw the first piece of this munitions series, Divine Ammunition, the other night, it was about a week ago. It really blew me away, Al.
Oh, thank you.
The statement was so strong and yet, you know, really quite subtle. You have to really examine it to see, wow, everything is made from a shell casing, a bullet, or something related to guns and ammo.
My approach has a lot to do not just with the politics and the art scene, but has a lot also to do with the history of art. And I have references in a lot of my work with art history, religious history, world history. But the art world has gone through its own changes over time, and a lot of current contemporary artwork is pretty much inaccessible to the general public. You have to have an education to access it, to understand what they're talking about, because it's art about art making. And I never agreed with that kind of art making. I've always been a person who likes content. My heroes, which are very few in the art world, are people like Daumier, who went to jail for doing political cartoons and stuff, or Goya, mm-hmm. who pretty much went nuts at the end of his life, but really expressed everything, like in Los Caprichos, you know, all the caprices of life. Those are the people I've always admired, and those are the people who informed. I'm a self-taught artist. I don't have a formal education in art.
And you're self-taught as a machinist, it appears.
I'm self-taught in all of the art stuff.
You've got welding gear here, drill presses, and you just trained yourself in all of this?
Yeah, a little at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's one step at a time. But
Now, where do you get all your ammo and your bullets, and does Homeland Security have a file on you?
Well, I'm sure about that. I get a lot of stuff online. You can buy used shell casings. I used to buy new ones, and then I have to make them look old, and I found out you can buy used ones, mm-hmm. which some people reload.
Yeah.
So they're called reloading supplies. And I also buy bullets. Those are new, but I can make them look old with chemicals. And so I've become a chemist, too. I can show you a huge amount of chemicals. I have a whole room full.
Well, we should get you some honorary doctorates for all this.
You know, the degrees don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I did teach in the college level, and when they hired me, I said, hey, I don't have a degree. They said, no, you have the equivalent. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, I'll teach.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like being a teacher.
Yeah.
I did it for a few semesters.
Mm-hmm.
But I produced a few good artists, you know, really inspired them to continue and become professional. But you asked about making a living. You know, a lot of years I had to supplement my income, and I started a restoration business here in my studio, and we restore, my son works with me on that. Mm-hmm. We restore mostly ethnic art, but also contemporary art. So I can restore almost anything and back to its original condition. So it's just a talent, I guess. But that's become a fairly lucrative way to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to do that full time, or I'm not after making lots of money. I'm actually just after continuing to make what I make.
Mm-hmm.
And so I fall back on the restoration business whenever my work mm-hmm. isn't selling.
So let's walk over here by Pennsylvania Avenue. You have a scale mock-up that is under construction of the White House. And tell us what these pedestal bases are.
Okay, these are the columns for the White House in the in the front and in the back, the north and south side, we have a series of columns. I'm using machine gun barrels from some Belgian machine guns. Mm-hmm. And they have, the White House has capitals on the columns. They call them Roman capitals. Some people use Greek, you know, Ionic, or there's all these different names. These are Roman capitals, and they're a little bit different. And so each of these capitals has, let's see, 4, 8, 12, 16, 17, 18. This is 19 pieces of metal that have been cut and shaped and filed to make one column. Even though the bulk of the column is the gun barrel, but all the other parts give it the character for the White House. So when it's all done, this is not going to be very white, by the way. It's going to have indications that it once was white, but it's going to be pretty orange, rusty.
And where are you going to put Melania?
Now, actually, I have something inside all these pieces in the reliquary series. For example, that church we described, I call it Revelation 1. Inside is a Bible, like a 150-year-old Bible, open to Revelation. And then, so you can see the word Revelation if you really look carefully into the windows. On the facing page, I sized a facsimile of Albrecht Dürer's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, so that just to add a little bit of an apocalyptic push to it. So that, but that's so subtle that most people who look at the artwork, they don't even know there's something inside unless. So I try to put something red in many of them, so that it'll catch the eye and then get people to look closely. In this one, the White House, a red Make America Great hat is going to be inside. I don't know what else is going to be in there yet. I'm still designing, and I may use all the different color Trump hats, but certainly red, and it'll be in a prominent spot in the window so that people will look close. Yeah. But I have ideas where I want to put in all kinds of suggestive debris. I'm still designing. I'm unclear where. I like the option to keep changing as I design a piece, and so that's probably what's going to happen here. But there will be stuff inside, and part of it will be Trump hats.
Okay.
This is going to be really different for me. It's also one of the bigger pieces I've done.
And just imagining the level of detail and the painstaking work that goes into each element, do you think that you'll finish this before his first term or his impeachment?
I don't know. We're in a race. I am in a hurry. This generally a piece this size takes me a little over a year to make. I'm trying to do it a lot faster because I think he will be impeached. And if not, he'll resign because he's not up to the job. Just this weekend he talked about how hard it is and how it's much harder than he thought it would be.
And they won't let him drive a car anymore.
It's like they shouldn't let him tweet either. They got to take away his toys, all his toys, including that red button. He can keep the one for Cokes. But the other one has to go.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm taking aim, but I do feel like he might be out before I finish this. I'm hoping to get this in the public eye before he's out of office, but that doesn't mean I want him to stay in office longer than he ought to.
So let me ask you just about your relationship to the Bay Area art community. I've lived here for a long time and driven by the DeRosa Art Preserve for years. And finally, about 10 days ago, I went to visit. And I was really struck. Rene DeRosa was an heir to a fortune. He worked as a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. He was an early landowner in the wine country, the Napa Valley, right there in the Carneros area.
He started.
And he had 500 acres. He sold 300 in order to fund his passion for collecting art. Tell me how you knew him and how you fit into that group of artists.
Well, way back, I don't know, I think this was in the 70s, late 70s. My studio partner, David Best, was building a treehouse up on his land. It was like five huge eucalyptus trees growing out of one humongous trunk. And he had a multi-level treehouse, and it was having problems. I have a background in structural design. I worked in engineering as a draftsman when I was young. And so I have a good sense of structure. And so I was helping him, you know, refine and strengthen his treehouse.
And did you hang that old car from the eucalyptus tree?
No, I didn't do that. I wish I had. But no, it's a beauty. It's been there for, God, 30 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, Renee's wife, Veronica, had a son and a daughter. And the son was a teenager at the time and was going through all kinds of teenage problems and being a problem himself. And so when David and I were working on a treehouse, we snagged him to come up and help and make him useful. And we really connected. And so then he would come down to our studio, and because David and I shared the studio at that time. And he'd hang out, and he was learning things. He was just about 16. He and I actually became pretty good friends. I hired him as an assistant when he got out of high school, and he worked for me for about a year. And in those days, I was poor. He slept on the floor. I slept on a mattress on the floor. I mean, he lived with me because we were working actually 18 and 20-hour days.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked 7 days a week then, and he worked six. So he really learned how to work, and that informed his whole future. But I basically mentored him, and we're still very close friends to this day.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of my very closest friends.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just a personal thing between Jock, his name's Jock McDonald, and he's also my photographer and has been since he's 18.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he has developed, and he's really a good professional photographer now, but his photography early on was not so great. So, but, you know, again, that kind of support helps a person develop.
Mm-hmm.
So Renee and I, on the other hand, did not hit it off super well. We were friends, but he didn't like my work. He was not into politics. He liked art that was fun and funny.
A lot of whimsical stuff there.
A lot of whimsical. And my stuff was not whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
But I was doing Beggars and stuff, and I was doing the Icarus series. He had no interest in that sort of thing.
But he was drawn to Robert Arneson, and Arneson did a lot of things with strong political statements.
Late.
Mm.
Only at the end, his Nuclear Head series and stuff.
And the Moscone, yeah.
Yeah, that was all very late in Arneson's life. Arneson's earlier work, for the bulk of his career, was very tongue-in-cheek, right up Renee's alley.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely a perfect fit. And there are drawings as well as sculptures and things like that from Arneson.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Arneson was a terrific artist. But again, it was all the whimsical thing that really grabbed Renee.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't into, and he and I had issues around ideas of integrity.
Mm.
And that gets personal, and I don't want to talk about his personal life or mine in that respect. But I'm very strong on ideas around integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an uncompromising person in that way. When I believe something, I really believe it, and I act on it, and I live it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we parted ways in some areas there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas David Best, and he meshed beautifully, and he really championed David's work, mm-hmm. because it had whimsy, but also they shared a lot of concepts of being,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so we were not really close. But even up to his death, I would visit him, and we would have great conversations about art and people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he was not going to buy my work. He has a few bronzes, yeah. that he got when I was really in my earliest shows,
mm-hmm.
and they were from the Dancer series. which, you know, is like 1970s, mm-hmm. a long time ago. But they're good pieces, but they're not. He has that big derby car. That sort of got me out of obscurity. Mm-hmm. But he was also, I hate to say it, a little bit tight, you know, financially. It really irritated me because I was, you know, living on practically nothing. And here was a guy who's a millionaire, and he was bargaining with every artist. And so, like, he was interested in my crucifix on the B-29. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't pay the price. At the time, I think it was $4,000. And I said, every time we were met at a party, after he'd had some drinks, he'd say, "Hey, Al, how much is that crucifix?" And I'd say, "Renee?
For you, special price."
Yeah. I'd say, for anyone else, $4,000. For you, $5,000. And I would never give up. I wouldn't sell it to him for anything less. Uh-huh. And he wouldn't buy it. But I played with him because he played with all the artists. He would go to graduation shows, you know, when people have a show when they get their masters and stuff. And he would lowball if he was interested. He was trying to do great picks. Like if you picked a Rauschenberg in the 50s, it would increase in value 1,000-fold in 20 years. Mm-hmm. He was hoping to do that, so he would go to the graduation shows. But he wouldn't pay the student price, and he would offer him half, and they would take it.
Well, he came from old money, and you know how it gets old, right?
Yeah, it hangs around in your bank account.
Well, cobwebs. Al, as we wrap up, what would you like to share with our listeners here about the work you do and the motivation for it?
I think social commentary art is, well, it's more popular now than it has been for a lot of years. But I think that it's important for people to do this kind of art, and it's important for people to see it because it's provocative. And I consider myself actually a provocateur. I don't care what people think when they look at my work. I just want to make them think. And I want to make them think about the symbols that are in front of them. There's violence, there's religious references, there's historical references. And depending on your background, your education, your awareness, you're going to get out of it what you bring to it. But I hide things in layers, and I hope that people will discover it. So let me offer that you can look at my work online at alfaro.com. The series we're talking about is the Reliquary series. And you just click on Reliquaries on the homepage. But there are many other series of my older work. And you can see all the things we're talking about from the Icarus series, the African series. And then there's a series on women, but they're not all just pretty women. So there's a lot to see. And I hope people who listen to this will go to the website and look at it. And then if you have the opportunity, see the shows in person.
And you have one in Bellevue, Washington?
Yeah, that's coming down this next week.
Let's give a date to that.
May 5th is the last day.
Okay.
And then this show is moving to the University of Wyoming at Laramie at their art museum. Mm-hmm. And it should be up there for a few months.
Great.
After that, I think we're going to show in San Francisco at the Museum of Craft and Design in 2018. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other shows lined up. USC is looking to do something with my work. So I just respond to people. I don't go looking for shows. They just happen. Mm-hmm. Of course, my art dealer helps arrange them, organize them, and all that. But mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who are interested these days in showing a stimulating and provocative show.
Well, it's a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you for letting me tour your shop here, your studio shop and engineering headquarters. And if it's any positive feedback for you, you provoked me. You are a successful provocateur.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with artist Al Faro. Be sure to visit his website and send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you.